Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Combating Corruption, an international conference here in the Vatican gets to grips with this insidious problem that costs countries billions of dollars and undermines the very fabric of society. Women's rights to own land, how helping women claim these rights is key to achieving many of the Millennium Development Goals. And Peter the Rock. Pope Benedict continues his reflections on the Apostle Peter at this week's General Audience. Welcome to the programme. Each year in countries around the world, an estimated $1 trillion is paid out in bribes. But what impact does such corruption have on the lives of ordinary people? And what is the most effective way of combating this huge and largely hidden problem? Those were the questions being asked at a recent international conference held here in the Vatican, looking at ways of mobilising governments, businesses, civil society and the church to try and fight the scourge of corruption. My colleague Susie Hodges has been taking a closer look.
Corruption is described as an insidious plague that reduces a government's ability to provide basic resources and services for its citizens. It also undermines democracy and damages the very fabric of society by impacting on people's values.
When corruption becomes endemic, it touches the hard core of the state, of the community, and it disorganizes all pre-established social systems.
François Vinquet was one of the participants at the Vatican Anti-Corruption Conference organized by the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. He's the chairman of the Anti-Corruption Commission of the International Chamber of Commerce in Paris. But is corruption getting worse? That was a question I put to Antonio Costa, Executive Director of the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, and another participant at the Vatican Conference.
Certainly we have awareness about corruption growing worldwide, which may give the feeling, including to media, that corruption per se is increasing, but that would be the wrong translation of a symptom into a cause. Point number two, one of the exercises we are engaged as United Nations at the moment is to identify parameters and ways of measuring corruption across countries so as to establish benchmarks. And that difficulty of finding what to measure shows that any statement that corruption is going up or going down may be premature because we don't really know, because we don't have the way of measuring that.
So, although opinion is divided on whether corruption is increasing or not, it can't be denied that in some countries it's endemic. One Asian nation where corruption has long blighted the political, economic and social landscape is the Philippines. Bishop Dinualdo Gutierrez of Marbel in Mindanao Island is director of the Filipino Church's National Secretariat for Social Action, Justice and Peace. He told me more about the extent of corruption in his country.
Well, it is pervasive, but better now than before.
Why is that?
Because there are now, first, many groups who had been educated, conscientized, who are socially aware of the evil of corruption, and that they have made initiatives to fight corruption. And in many instances, we had good results.
How, though, does corruption impact on the lives of the ordinary people, particularly perhaps the poor? Can you give us some examples?
Yes. Instead of money going to social services like education, healthcare, shelter, water, etc., the unscrupulous government officials pocket the money, depriving the many poor of the basic necessities in life.
But do you find that the ordinary people complain a lot about corruption? Is it something that is felt very keenly by the population?
Oh, yes. They had been complaining about this, and that's why it's easy to fight corruption, because the people themselves find out how important the issue is, meaning that if they don't do something, they will continue to suffer. So they have to fight if they want their lives to improve. So they are involved.
Contrary to what some people might assume, the practice of bribe-taking always has a damaging impact on the whole of society. Vinca again.
A bribe is never a gift. A bribe is always recovered in the cost price. And so whoever is bribing is making the bribed really paying for it. And this is paid through over-invoicing or through a reduction of the quality of products and prices. Therefore, the country which so-called benefits from this transaction is penalized through an over-invoicing, so more public spending, and as a result, probably a higher taxation.
But is it a fact that in the business world, if you work in certain sectors, it's known that perhaps you have to pay bribes if you want to get that business contract?
No, really, the awareness of the prohibition of the payment of bribes in the international trade is becoming better and better. A number of corporations, a number of multinationals, a number of larger enterprises have really understood that this was not possible anymore, because corruption is running against the very basis of the free market, free enterprise economy. So we cannot continue in this way anymore.
Surveys have shown that one of the industries that is most blighted by the practice of bribery and corruption is the oil and gas sector. Ian Gary is an expert on the extractive industries for the International Development Agency Oxfam and was another participant at the Vatican conference. He spells out the extent of the problem.
Well, I think in the last few years, there's been a growing awareness of how damaging corruption has been in countries that produce oil, gas, and other minerals. This has been called the resource curse or the paradox of plenty. And there's a new international campaign called Publish What You Pay, which is a civil society effort of more than 250 civil society organizations from around the world that are pushing the mandatory disclosure of revenues and contracts in oil, gas, and mining operations as a first step to combating corruption.
Hand in hand with this growing awareness of the damage caused by corruption is a growing campaign by the international community to combat this scourge. Costa again.
There is a much greater awareness of the costs. Cases of corruption, whether public or private, have been widely publicized. Initiatives have been undertaken. Government coalitions have collapsed, pushed by away and out of power because of public resentment against corruption. So there is a growing movement, and my conclusion by examining what happens in different countries is that we may be better positioned than ever to curb and deal with corruption because of this popular movement in favor of deciding something about it.
But what are the most effective ways of fighting corruption? Vinca says the answer lies in adopting a series of strategies to tackle a complex phenomenon that, by its very nature, is a hidden one.
It's really having good legislation, it's having a good judiciary, and also having self-regulatory rules within the corporations. That's not enough as such. You need to have a good education of the people in the corporations in order to make sure that they are aware of the self-regulation norms and that they apply it in the day-to-day life.
When it comes to the people, though, there is perhaps this perception. Corruption has always existed, and it's probably destined always to exist. There's a certain complacency here. How can one fight that?
Well, homicide has been forbidden since the Decalogue, and there is still homicide. Now, international corruption is forbidden since the Convention of 1997, and as I said, I don't believe it has disappeared, but I believe it is stabilizing, and probably it's going to decrease in the future.
Bishop Gutierrez is one of the leading members of an interfaith commission fighting corruption at the local level in his diocese. He told me about one success story they had.
In the last election, cases were filed in court by this group, Spergo. It is led by the parish priest. The vice chairman is a Protestant pastor. The different people's organizations are there. Some local government officials like mayors are there fighting corruption in the provincial government. So the ombudsman sent investigators, the commission on audit, audited the financial statement, and several supposed to be NGOs were non-existent. So they were giving money to non-existing organizations, and these were discovered. Spergo used that to file cases against the provincial governor, vice governor, the board members. And first, the immediate result is they lost in the elections. Second, they were immediately suspended. Now the criminal case is going on. So these are what you might call success stories.
When it comes to the global campaign against corruption, Antonio Costa believes that the Catholic Church can use its moral authority to play a more active role in preaching about the evils of corruption.
We need to mobilize the whole of society, whether we're talking about civil society, whether we're talking about media, whether we talk about the places of faith. Now, the Catholic Church, as being so powerful in the moral imperatives, it underlines in the life of everybody, I think it can indeed exert a role of a moral nature, of a leadership nature. And I would like to see, indeed, the Church being more engaged, even in terms of its teaching and preaching about the importance of integrity. I was just kidding, and perhaps this is extracurricular with respect to your question, whether an act of corruption is a venial or is a mortal sin. I do not know, but certainly what could have been seen in the past as okay, a little greasing of the wheels, today should be seen as a major blow to a human dignity on the part of those who pay for corruption and suffer because of corruption. It could be seen as a major impact on society at large. So I would like the Catholic Church to represent it also in terms of the theology of these illegal activities.
Thinker too says he would like to see the Church to be more proactive on this issue.
The Catholic Church can give moral strength. It can give ethical guidance. It can give also the strength of its global structure. The Catholic Church is the first private global organization in the world. And through this structure and through its moral strength, it can give really to the prohibition of international corruption a very sound and solid ground.
But is it doing this enough in your view?
Not yet. It's probably coming. I think really it is time for the Church to move into this direction. It is true, a certain number of indications have been given up to now, but it has to happen in a stronger, in a more fundamental way.
Susie Hodges was talking to François Vinque, Antonio Costa, Ian Gary and Philippine Bishop Dinualdo Gutierrez, all participants in the recent Vatican Conference on Combating Corruption. In Africa, a new generation of AIDS widows are rebelling against the traditional practice of giving up their homes and land when their husbands die. In India, cooperatives of women farmers are demanding the right to own the land they must look after when their husbands migrate to cities in search of work. These are just two examples of the way in which a woman's land rights are increasingly being seen as central to the fight against gender inequality and a key to achieving many of the development goals drawn up by wealthy nations in the year 2000. Women's access to land was also the subject of a recent conference here in Rome, organised by the UN-sponsored International Land Coalition and a Canadian institute called the International Development Research Centre. Sabine Pallas of the ILC explains why the problem of land ownership is so central to the fight against discrimination and poverty across the developing world.
Access to land has an impact on the achievement of various development goals, Millennium Development Goals, not just one. But the one that we could look at in particular related to women is the goal number 3 of promoting gender equality and empowering women. And this is important because now in developing countries, women own less than 2% of the land and they have less than 5% of the support services related to land, like technical assistance. And giving women secure access to land doesn't only contribute to household income, but also to food security, which again bears generally on the poverty reduction goals. It increases the well-being of mothers and children, so that's another part of the Millennium Development Goals, and it also has an important part of increasing women's political participation, which is part of this promoting gender equality.
Though women's rights to land ownership have already been enshrined in a UN Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, in practice they are rarely recognised or implemented. My colleague Paul Antham talked to Liz Faber, Senior Programme Officer with the International Development Research Centre, who is based in New Delhi and has seen firsthand the importance of mobilising women to demand their right to land ownership.
As Sabine was saying, it's very important because if they don't have title in their name, for example, or ownership of land resources in their name, they're then not able to access credit, have access to education in many places. For example, they may have land or be working with their husband on the land, but often, and in many cases in India, it's a patrilineal society, which means that the women move to the man's household, and so they give up their ties to the land of their family and move into a man's household, and they will work the land together. But if something happens where that man leaves to go and migrate for work and then takes up another job and another wife in some cases, or the husband may die, and so the woman then has no rights over that land, and in many cases the family of the husband will insist that she has to leave, and then she has nowhere to go. So she can sometimes go back to her family's home, but in many cases she's even more destitute than she was certainly before she was married. So it's a very big problem in terms of inheritance. And women also will not be able to access other resources, as I was saying, for credit, for example, to be able to use that money to invest more in their land or to access agricultural technologies. And any of the extension services for agriculture or for education, they'll often target the male head of the household. They won't consider the woman as part of that household. So again, she loses out in terms of access to information and access to those other resources. So she's very much left in poverty.
I would like to add to that of course now with the high rates of HIV/AIDS in Africa, particularly in Eastern Africa and Southern Africa, this is something that affects a lot of women because the men die and they're left with the children, with the AIDS orphans. And if they are then chased off the land, it's a particularly urgent situation to help these women because they have no rights over the land and they also have the children to take care of.
What are the main ways in which the organisations, the UN and Liz, your organisation, what can be done?
For us in particular, it's important that our members get information on this issue that can help them in their advocacy work, so they can lobby with their governments to have support for these women, to possibly have changes in law, to improve the implementation of policies that are supposed to help women. So for us, it's very important to get the research to back up the civil society when they make their demands.
What has the response been, and is that very diverse depending on the different parts of the world?
Well, one of the key issues is that there is an international convention called CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. And within that convention, women are supposed to have equitable land rights. And many governments have signed onto this convention. And they are actually changing some of the policies and laws so that women can have equitable access to land and have land title in their name, for example. But the problem is that even though those policies are there, in practice, it is a completely different story. And women are not able to again, access title, have their name on deeds of land. And governments are supposed to report back to how they are progressing towards the principles of CEDAW. But unfortunately, it's still very much challenged in practice. So we're hoping that this initiative can look at ways where women can mediate within the system and be able to better implement these policies.
Are there examples in particular countries where lobbying and where measures taken by the organisations have actually begun to reap fruit, well, quite literally, where progress has actually been made?
We hear from our members that they're using, for example, a report that we did on the implementation of this convention to eliminate discrimination against women. We hear that they use these documents to lobby their government. So it's a useful tool for them in their work. Of course, when it comes to the implementation of policy, it's more difficult to ascertain what sort of impact a policy has, because you often don't see an immediate effect. And the signing of an international convention in particular is not something that is immediately translated into something concrete. We work a lot on trying to raise awareness, trying to raise the knowledge that women have of their rights, because that is the sort of first step to empower women so that they can then claim their rights, because often they're not even aware that they have certain rights.
Generally, women's issues are still underrepresented. It's a very, very small segment of the work that's taking place within the UN, within government agencies, even within agencies like ours, that are really addressing the women's issue. So it's very under-supported, but very critical when we look at how much more they are discriminated against in the land debate.
You have a general awareness now of gender issues and of the need for gender equality and the various arguments that there are, the economic arguments, the social justice arguments. But often it doesn't go beyond an awareness and a discourse, and it isn't put into practice. So this is what we were trying to achieve with this meeting, to actually look at how can we translate this theoretical arguments into practical solutions.
And there are a number of amazing initiatives that are happening on the ground where women are collectively coming together and going to their village council, which are generally governed by men.
Do you have any examples?
In northeast India, there's a state called Nagaland, and there are a group of women who have come together. This is a very traditional society. Men are very much the ones who are the governing bodies. They also have a lot of control within the household as well. And so women have been quite upset that they were not able to access credit, to be able to get loans, to be able to do other things or to invest into their land, whereas the men were able to. So they actually went and collectively came together. There were about 20 women, farmers, and they went to the Village Development Council and negotiated with the governing body, which were men, to say, we would like to have some land in our name so that we can get a loan, because we'd like to do other things related to both agriculture, around processing of fruits, and also around some handicrafts and developing an enterprise that they would sell broadly. So it's really amazing, this type of initiative that's taking place. And we have both facilitated some of those initiatives through our more action-oriented type of research and development projects, but we also want to learn from that initiative. So the learning is how we can understand how women can come together, how we can support other women and other women's groups to come together to be able to do similar things.
My colleague Paul Antham was talking to Liz Faber of the International Development Research Centre and Sabine Pallas of the International Land Coalition. And finally, here in the Vatican on Wednesday, pilgrims and visitors from around the world gathered for Pope Benedict's weekly general audience in St. Peter's Square. Delegations at this week's audience included a group of firefighters from the New York City Fire Department and members of an Italian peace pilgrimage. My colleague Charles Collins tells us more about what the Pope had to say.
On a very sunny and clear June day, Pope Benedict greeted tens of thousands of pilgrims in St. Peter's Square for his weekly general audience. He continued his ongoing catechesis on the apostles of the church. For the past few weeks, he's been talking about the apostle Peter.
In our weekly catechesis on the mystery of the church's apostolic ministry, we have been considering the figure of the apostle Peter. The name Peter was given to Simon, the son of John, by Jesus himself. In the biblical tradition, a change of name often accompanied a new mission. Christ wished to give Peter a special place among his apostles, and from the beginning, Peter often appears as their leader and spokesman. After he proclaimed the apostles' faith in Christ as the Son of God, Jesus made Peter the rock on which he would build his church. At the Last Supper, the Lord prayed for Peter that his faith would not waver and that he would confirm his brethren in faith. Peter was the first of the apostles to see the risen Lord, and he continued to exercise a preeminent role in the early church, as we see in the Book of Acts. The ministry which Christ entrusted to Peter is a constitutive element of the church and is closely linked to the very source of her life, the Lord's Paschal Mystery, and its memorial in the Holy Eucharist.
After his catechesis, he greeted pilgrims in various languages, including English.
Upon all present to his audience, I cordially invoke an abundance of joy and peace in our Lord Jesus Christ. Sit nomen Domini benedictum.
Et nunc et usque in saeculum.
Adiutorium nostrum in nomine Domini.
Qui feci caelum et terra.
Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, Pater et Filius et Spiritus Sanctus.
And that brings us to the end of today's programme, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. Don't forget you can always find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org and click on the English icon. Stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.